So, in part, to continue the introductory course that ended a couple of weeks ago, I wanted today to give a talk on what's known as the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are the core central teachings of Buddhism, and they're very much at the heart of what the Buddhist notion of mindfulness practice is trying to address. It's kind of the central theme of Buddhist spirituality. And the Four Noble Truths, as a teaching, have a phenomenal profundity to them. And when a person understands them deeply, it leads to a kind of certainty about life, a certainty about how to be in life, which is said to make a person fearless. It's said that on one hand, the Four Noble Truths are very easy to understand in a superficial way. I can explain to you in 2 minutes, and you can go home and tell someone else what they were. But it's said that only someone who is fully enlightened understands them fully. And my own experiences of them is that over the years of practice, my appreciation and understanding of them has deepened and deepened and deepened. And so it continues to this day, and I imagine it will continue for quite a while still. The placing our spiritual life in the context of the Four Noble Truths makes spiritual life a lot easier than maybe it can be. For one thing, the Buddha, part of the brilliance of what the Buddha had to offer was he put the foundation of the spiritual practice he offered on something that was quite understandable in everyday life. And it didn't depend on some kind of faith or belief in something which we could have no ultimate certainty about whether it really existed or not. There's no metaphysical speculation or metaphysical entity or belief, reality, that the Buddha is positing. But he's about positing or talking about something that's very practical. And so the Four Noble Truths are stated traditionally very succinctly, very briefly. The first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. That's all it says. The nobility of suffering, if you'd like. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. And the fourth noble truth is a truth of the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And what the Buddha did when he formulated these four steps was he was borrowing from the ancient Indian medical model, how ancient Indian doctors diagnosed an illness. In the ancient Indian system, they would recognize the illness, which is recognizing the suffering. They would recognize the cause of the illness. They'd recognize the possibility of a cure. And they would know what the steps were to get that cure. So the Buddha borrowed from this medical model to formulate his spiritual understanding. We all suffer. It's part of everyone's life. And we have to see that very clearly and very honestly. The first noble truth is a call for us to take our suffering very seriously, to look at it very honestly. It's all too common for many people to turn away from their suffering, to avoid it, to deny it, to numb out from it. We probably all know people who do it through alcohol, who do it through drugs, who do it through working too much, overwork, who do it through food, who do it through sex, who do it through television. All kinds of ways in which people would rather not be present for their life as it is because it's so difficult and painful. And so they numb out, they turn away. So the first noble truth is a call to be really honest, to face honestly and squarely our suffering as it occurs. The second noble truth then is the cause of suffering, and the cause is, the Buddha defined, as our drivenness. Actually, he didn't use that word, that's my word. But the word that he used was thirst. And sometimes in English that's translated as the word desire. And that raises a lot of problems for people. But his word was thirst. And thirst has a sense of a kind of craving, a kind of drivenness. If you're out in the desert and really thirsty, you're kind of like, you know, will claw your way to water, you know, push everyone else out of your way. Or there's kind of a drivenness, a kind of, maybe the English word addiction is a good word, except we tend to reserve that word for kind of strong addictions. We're all addicted in various kind of, Buddha said everyone's an addict unless you're liberated. And it can be very, very subtle, the forms of our addiction. But I call it a drivenness, a compulsion. Our drivenness, our driven attachments, our things we need to have, or things we absolutely say we don't want to have, things we avoid. We put up walls of resistance and walls of wanting and walls of not wanting, which are very brittle walls. And as the winds of life hit those brittle walls, they crack and they fall and they hurt. So part of the task of Buddhist practice is to dismantle the walls that are interfering with the wind passing freely. And so we have to understand the nature of those walls. And the Buddha said the nature of those walls is to be built by our thirst, by our drivenness, our compulsion, by our attachment, our craving, our resistance. And then it's possible to live a life, it's possible to discover a way of being in life where the mind or the heart is in no way driven. It's no way acting on compulsion. It's no way acting on automatic habit. It's no way acting on automatic resistance and aversion. It's not thirsty for anything, but rather feels satisfied and content. It feels satiated. It feels at ease and at peace with itself. And the Buddha said that it's not so easy to do this. This first four steps of the Noble Truth sound very simplistic. We have suffering. There's a cause of suffering, and there's a possibility to end suffering. And some people might think it's a real disservice, or maybe it is a disservice to some people, to state it so simply that their suffering is, you know, can be described in such a brief way. My suffering is so huge. But the Buddha recognized that, and because he recognized that it's quite complicated, our situations, our life, that there has to be a whole strategy, a whole prescription, a whole path that supports us and makes it easier for us to relax and let go of our compulsion and our thirst. And he called this the Eightfold Path. Eight different steps that are useful to kind of look at in your life and organize your life around these points of view. So the beauty of this is that there's nothing stated about a divine being or divine reality, ultimate reality, in this statement, in this Four Noble Truths. It's like a medical model. And everyone's experience falls into it. Now, you might still protest and say, this is too simplistic. It's not profound enough. It's not grand enough. It's much more interesting to have some great, wonderful, rich theology where you can, you know, all-powerful deity. You know, it's kind of, I'm not knocking it exactly, but it's very, very, you know, it's quite beautiful, you know, to have a great, beautiful theology to kind of, and Buddhism is kind of theologically poor. So you say, well, this is kind of simplistic to have this whole spiritual life, you know, based on this poor, simple statement. Seems a bit simplistic. But let me offer you a couple of models, a couple of analogies that might help you understand how it can be so useful. The first analogy is that of an ancient story of long ago. There was a king or queen, and this king was out walking around his queendom, and one day, stubbed his toe against some rock, and really, or he stepped on a sharp rock, and he kind of hurt his foot. He maybe broke it, kind of cut the foot a little bit in the sharp rock, and so he called together all his ministers and said, you know, this can't be. And what I want you to do is to carpet the kingdom with leather, because then it would be safe for me to walk. I wouldn't have to hurt myself anymore in the sharp rocks. And one of the ministers said, I have a better idea. And then instead of carpeting the whole kingdom, let's just make shoes for everyone. Let's just put leather underneath everyone's soles, their feet. And that saved a lot of time and expense for the queendom. And so it's like that in our spiritual life. If we try to take care of everything and put some kind of safety devices or protection over everything, it's kind of impossible. But if you can just take care of the place where you actually touch the reality, where you actually meet reality, the place of real contact with reality, in that place have some protection, then you can take it with you everywhere you go. And it's a lot easier, a lot cheaper. And this teaching of the Four Noble Truths is a teaching that focuses on the place where we actually meet reality, where there's actually contact with reality. Each moment, we meet reality, and you hear my voice, you're looking at me perhaps, there's the feelings of your body, there's sensations in your shoulders, there's the thoughts that you have. In the present moment, you have contact with something in your own direct experience. To actually have some shoe to wear, when you meet reality directly, that's the place where you can find the opportunity to step off the clinging or the thirst or the addiction that you have. So I don't know if that made sense, but I'll continue. And then another analogy is that of if you're a nature photographer and you go to the great deserts or the great savannas of Africa, and you want to take photographs of all the wild animals there, you would exhaust yourself running around the savanna with a camera, kind of chasing all the animals, trying to catch them all and finding them and all that. It's kind of a silly way of doing it, perhaps. But if you simply place yourself at the watering hole and wait, all the animals will come to you. So the Four Noble Truths are like the watering hole. That if you begin studying, understanding your life from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths, all the different issues that are important, really important and really practically important and real issues of your life will all come to you to be addressed and to be taken care of. And you don't have to go and get a PhD in Buddhist studies to understand all, you know, everything about Buddhism and life and reality and psychology and everything. You know, all the profundity that exists out there to be discovered. All that you need will come to you if you sit there at the watering hole of the Four Noble Truths. Isn't that great? So that seems like a good plug. So the first noble truth, to go over this again then, a little bit another time, the truth of suffering. We all suffer. Human beings, by the kind of the nature of our limitations, having a relatively short lifespan, by having bodies that don't, you know, are not robotic, they get old, they get hurt, they get injured, they get sick. Things happen to our mind, our brain. There's things that are out of our control. We stub our toe. It's very satisfying and relieving to me to be reminded that the Buddha. You've seen the wonderful statues and paintings of this great radiant being, you know. You never see him in statues as an old man that he was. You see him in the peak of youth and radiant and shining and just all the right skin tone and just the right little smile on his face and no wrinkles. And he just seems really great, right? It's a great ideal to live up to. The Buddha had a bad back. Isn't that nice to know? The Buddha had a bad back. There were times where he couldn't teach because he had to lay down. And he had one of his senior students teach instead of him because of his bad back. So the Buddha had a bad back. Some of us have bad backs. I have a bad back. The Buddha also experienced sorrow when there was a massacre in his home kingdom. It's normal when there's a loss like that to feel sorrow, and sorrow is a kind of suffering. In looking at Buddha said there is suffering in this world, and I've known a lot of people when they first hear these kinds of teachings in Buddhist circles, some people are appalled. Any kind of emphasis on suffering, and they get angry. But there are some people who find it such a huge relief to come into a setting where someone is, for the first time perhaps, really saying, look, there's really suffering in this world, and it's okay to look at it, it's okay to admit it. We don't have to think of ourselves as failing or as a personal failure, the fact that there is suffering in our life. It's built into being a human being. So, as I like, you know, I like to kind of say sometimes, maybe this is not a nice thing to say, but when two people marry each other, because I do marriages very occasionally, it's a wonderful and joyous time. But built into the marriage is the idea that the way that marriage is usually supposed to last, you know, lifetime, traditional sense, right? So built into that is the notion that one of them is going to die before the other. That's built into the system. And that's a kind of suffering, you know, it's unfortunate. But you're marrying into that kind of system. You're marrying into an imperfect system where someone's going to die first. So we know that. So that's part of life. And if it doesn't, if it isn't a traditional kind of marriage, and then more likely there's a different kind of suffering when it ends, right? So it's a kind of suffering, it's part of it. Even though there's a lot of joy and it's a wonderful thing to do. So to call it for what it is. I remember Joseph Goldstein told me he doesn't like to do weddings at all as a teacher. But he said that, I guess the first time, maybe the only time, maybe, he ever performed a wedding, he gave a Dharma talk as part of the ceremony, and he gave a Dharma talk on death. I don't want to make light of these things. I don't want to make light of the suffering of life. And Buddhism is not meant to make light of it. It takes it very seriously. And what it's saying is there's some real peace, some real relief, some real wisdom and maturity that comes with seeing it and looking at it directly as it is. When we look at suffering directly, we see two kinds of suffering. And this is a very important point to understand what Buddhism has to teach. There is what can be called inevitable suffering and maybe optional suffering. Inevitable suffering is things that just comes with being a human being. Bad backs, stubbing our toe against sharp rocks, having loved ones that we know die. There's all kinds of things that just come with life. And some of the stuff is out of our control. You know, we don't know when the next earthquake is going to hit the Bay Area. And that's going to cause a lot of suffering. We don't know all kinds of things. Yesterday I was driving up 84 to where I live up in the mountains. And there had just been an accident before I got there. And the only car that was on the scene was upside down, and the roof of the car was completely crashed like a pancake. And you know, these things happen. They come out of the blue for many of us, and we can't control life and can't say that life has to be always a certain way. Part of a mature human life is to recognize the inevitable aspects of things that happen to us which are not our doing, not our responsibility. So there's an inevitable suffering. But that then there's also the optional suffering. And Buddhism is primarily addressing the optional suffering. And the optional suffering is intimately related, for many of us, to the inevitable suffering. And I'll explain that in a few minutes. The optional suffering is a suffering that arises out of the way that we react and respond to what happens in life. Our reactions, our choices, the choices in which ways we respond are much more choice than most of us realize. If I, to make a really simplistic, simple, maybe example, if I am driving my wonderful car that I have, and it's very important for me to see, for you, that people see me, my wonderful car, because you see that I'm a really good person, you know, it's sort of kind of status that comes with my car, you know, and people can look up to me, and you know, I kind of fit into the local scene, you know, I kind of one notch up maybe from everyone else, and you know, it's kind of nice, and it kind of makes me feel good, right, to be able to be in a really good car, right? And then one day my car is in the shop, and the shop gives me this really old, beat up, teeny little Honda Civic from 1982 to drive around. And I suffer. Why do I suffer? One of the reasons could be because it's a tremendously important self-image that I've cultivated with the kind of car I drive is no longer being upheld. One of you might see me in this old Honda Civic. And then you say, oh, he's a Honda Civic kind of guy. You know. And suddenly my status is dropped, and you know, what I think my status is. And so my suffering in that kind of silly example arises out of the way in which I've chosen to hold on to a self-image and how to protect it and worried about how the people see me. And that's optional. It's optional to have a self-image like that. If you're running late and you're driving someplace and you're running late and you end up in kind of some kind of traffic jam and you're going to be even later, most people will feel frustrated or impatient or angry. It's fairly common in this world. But is it necessary to feel those things? Is it built into the nature of the universe? Are we genetically programmed that traffic jam means frustration? I remember one delightful day driving home with driving across the Golden Gate Bridge on a Friday afternoon at 5-6, no, Saturday, anyway, with Ajahn Amaro and a couple of another monk. And I think I was driving. And there was great backup in the traffic. And we took forever, you know, to get across the bridge and, you know, these monks couldn't care less. They couldn't care less if it took 10 days to get across the Golden Gate Bridge. They were just there. This is what was happening. They didn't, you know, they weren't frustrated. I think they had to get somewhere, but they chose not to buy in or get caught up or get frustrated. They chose not to let their compulsions and their thirst, their drivenness affect the state of their mind, the state of their heart. It's possible in rush hour traffic to let go and just be there, enjoy the sky, enjoy the other drivers, maybe if they're smiling enough or not, or to have compassion for them and look around, do loving kindness practice. There's all kinds of ways to be. It's optional to get all worked up and tense. Maybe the example of a traffic jam is, you know, simple enough you can say, oh yeah, it's kind of true, I kind of agree with Gil here, you know, maybe it is optional. But even in a traffic jam, it can be very hard to see clearly how our automatic reactions are really our choices and that we have any choice to step off it. Even more so with more dramatic examples in our life. The task of practice, of mindfulness practice, is to help us be calm and settled enough in the present moment so we can really see the moment of contact, really see the moment where we meet life, how we actually respond directly and immediately that builds up the cycles of reactivity and suffering. To be there with it, to be right there where the shoe touches the ground, the foot touches the ground. And then we can see how all these things arise. The example which I give maybe all too much, but driving at night up a skyline and getting angry when the people had their high beams on at night driving towards me, and my reaction, it's a kind of suffering to be angry. Not everyone realizes that. Some people think it's great to be angry. But I felt, felt the suffering in being angry. And so I used the mindfulness to look at that. What was going on with me when I got angry? And I looked very carefully, and for a long time I didn't see anything. I just, headlights, high beams, angry. High beams, angry. And then one day, because I was noticed that just before, in a flash, before the anger, I was afraid. And it was the fear that then I responded to in terms of pushing away something, having aversion, having anger. And once I saw the fear, I no longer had to trigger the anger. I can just stay there in the fear. The fear, I think, is just part of, maybe it was reasonable in the context of being blinded. The anger was not necessary, was optional. And even though there's a kind of discomfort with being afraid, it's part of the inevitable part of experiences of life, and they're appropriate to feel those sometimes. So, even when there's inevitable suffering, how do we relate to it? How do we choose to relate to it? What is the values? What's the sense of self? What are the attachments that come into play with the inevitable suffering? There's good grief, as Charlie Brown says, and there's bad grief. I've known people who've gone through periods of grief in their life, and it's been so much more difficult for them to go through the discomfort of grief because of the way they related to the grief. They related to it as if something, there was a personal fault, there was something wrong with them. And that's a kind of attachment, it's kind of a drivenness, that's a kind of value that kind of clamps down and makes the whole situation worse. To have it, oh, if something's wrong with me, then I'm feeling this. And I know people who, you know, grieving process takes a long time sometimes. And after many months, people have friends say, aren't you over it yet? It's such a disservice to do that to people. Such a disservice. Because there's no way of knowing how long a person needs to grieve. But as soon as you say that, then the person might internalize the idea, something's wrong with me. And then they're adding a layer of suffering, which is optional. But it's very painful. So how do we relate? You know, what are we doing with inevitable suffering? You know, if you lose your job, sometimes it's out of your control. How does that tie into the self-concept that you have that drives you, or the fear that drives you, or the ambition that drives you, or is there something that drives you, that your drivenness, your addiction, something that is meeting that losing your job, that makes the whole situation worse? Losing a job is not a nice thing to do. It's an unpleasant situation, often. But to add on top of that, the tremendous clinging and despair and suffering because we're relating it to my self-image, my self-worth. We don't have to do that. Our inherent self-worth, we have inherent self-worth, which is not dependent on having a job or being in a relationship or anything at all. Just the nature of who we are. Part of the function of meditation is to help us relax enough so we can realize that our fundamental well-being, our fundamental self-worth and integrity is already in us. It's not a matter of doing something or undoing anything. So the first noble truth is to look at the suffering honestly and carefully and to notice the difference between inevitable and optional suffering. If it's inevitable suffering, can we simply leave it in the simplicity of the experience? Take care of the situation best we can, rest your back, do what you need to do to help in the situation, but not to add all the other things on top of it. All the drivenness and contractions and fears and ambitions and all the optional stuff we add. Can you see what's extra, what you add extra to it? A lot of our suffering, however, is optional to begin with. It's almost primarily optional stuff. As I think someone said, Mark Twain said, that he said, I've had a lot of troubles in my life, most of which never happened. So the second noble truth is the truth of our drivenness, our compulsiveness. The truth that there's a choice we make about how we choose to relate and respond to the world that adds additional extra layers of suffering on top of often which are difficult situations to begin with. Maybe not even difficult to begin with at all. Can we look very honestly at what motivates us, motivates our responses and reactions? Can we notice very clearly where we have attachment, where we have resistance and fear, and look at it very clearly and very honestly? This is what it's called for in Buddhism. You're called to ask, look very honestly and truthfully. And to do this process, it helps to meditate, because meditation will slowly allow you to see more clearly and give you this calmness and stability that allows you to see more deeply than you can with kind of a normal, kind of cluttered surface street mind that many people are walking around in. And I think, as I said, it's very hard for most of us to see the choices that we make in relationship to our optional suffering. And if you don't see the choices you have, you don't really have choices. And if you don't see the choices, then it's not so optional. But if you're really mindful and really carefully attentive, you can actually see where the moment of choice arises. And if you can see the moment of choice, you can choose another route. You can choose not to have that constriction of the mind or the heart. You can choose to be open-hearted, open-minded. So then there's a possibility of the release from suffering, the cessation of suffering. And this is, you know, the good news of Buddhism. So, you know, Buddhism isn't just simply focusing on suffering all the time. This is where the happiness part is, right? And basically, another way of talking with Four Noble Truths is that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's happiness, and there's a cause of happiness, or condition for happiness. So the Third Noble Truth is about the cessation, the ending of suffering. And for its reasons, for Buddhism, or the Buddha, preferred to state the goal of the religious life, the spiritual life, in negative terms, the cessation of suffering. And this was partly to, I believe, to overcome certain problems that can arise if you state the goal of religious life in positive terms. One is the danger of apprehension, of anticipation. If you describe some wonderful, blissful, ecstatic, peaceful state as being the goal of religious life, Buddhist life, then you're looking for it. People sort of create it artificially and measure themselves, you know, how well they're doing against it and all that. And they're kind of looking for it all the time as if something there that can kind of. But if it's stated negatively, you don't know what it looks like when it's, you know. You know, if. So we don't really know what the experience of freedom or liberation or enlightenment is, except when we experience it. And as it's frequently been told to me, it's never what you think it's going to be. So the whole idea of anticipating what it might be is really a big hindrance. Also, by stating it negatively, it tends to avoid the kind of attachments people might have to certain kinds of experience. But in any case, it might also seem kind of petty or simplistic or timid for this great world religion of Buddhism to state its highest religious goal as simply the cessation of suffering. You know, again, you know, there could be this. What about the great union with Brahma, or great union with a great, you know, whatever, or oneness with the cosmos sounds better than just cessation of suffering. You know, people have these great, great, great lofty ideals about what they want in their religious life. And these Buddhists are so, you know, theologically poor. But, it's possible that the Buddhists and the theologians are talking about the same thing. And the experience of the cessation of suffering is the mystical theologians. It's possible that, it's very, very, very closely akin to a state of grace. Can you imagine what your life would be like if you had no clinging and no fear? You were fearless and no clinging. If you had, the experience of cessation of suffering is an experience of an all-pervasive trust in life. Imagine if you trusted life so much that no matter what happened or what you can conceive of might happen to you, none of it ruffled your mind, none of it ruffled your heart, none of it caused you to be afraid or worried or shy or embarrassed or angry. It would be a pretty nice state, wouldn't it, to be that way? So the cessation of suffering, the state of grace, the state of not being driven anymore by compulsion. Isn't it great not to be compulsive anymore in any kind of way? So then the Buddha recognized that it's not so easy to do this. It's not so easy to do it directly, to let go of our attachments and our clinging. And it's not so easy always to see it very clearly and very honestly, completely, what's going on with us, because we're complicated beings and a lot of different forces and factors operating at once within us. So part of the prescription then is to take the eight pills, the Eightfold Path. One of which is the practice of mindfulness. The first two have to do with understanding. The Buddha said it's actually important for you to spend a little bit of time reflecting and thinking, using your thoughts and your ability to reflect, to come to some kind of understanding about your life and what's going on. One of the important things to really reflect deeply about is, what is your deepest intention in your life? What is the deepest, your heart's deepest longing or deepest wish? What do you most deeply want in your life? Very few people ask themselves that very seriously or very often. But to remind oneself and ask that, and look at that question regularly, almost daily, and to really drop down into the depths of your being, and what is most valuable, most important for you? What's the deepest values you want to live by? And remind yourself of that regularly. And then, can you begin living by that? Can you try to live by those values? If mindfulness meditation or practice, if Buddhism, in some way seems supportive of your heart's deepest intention, great, then you know exactly why you're doing it. If you don't see the connection between mindfulness practice and your heart's deepest intention, you can do one of two things. One is, you can come and talk to a teacher or some friends and see if they can help clarify the connection. Or if you see no connection at all, then just forget about mindfulness. Chuck the meditation if it doesn't support your deepest intention. So the Buddha said it's very important to look at your intention. And I'm suggesting it's very important to try to live by your deepest intention. Life is too precious and too short for us not to do that, to waste our time in doing other things. I've known enough people who pursued wealth only to be disappointed by what they got. As Lily Tomlin says, the thing about being in the rat race, even if you win, you're still a rat. So to look at your intention and your values. That seems like a reasonable thing to do. And the other thing in terms of reflection and thought the Buddha recommended is to actually think for a while, reflect and discuss the Four Noble Truths. Argue with them, criticize them, really grapple with them to really see if you can really understand them, understand how they can be helpful categories or frameworks for helping you understand your life. And then the Buddha said, that was the first two steps, the first two pills. The next three steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with your behavior. And this is something that American practitioners often rather not talk about as a generalization. It has to do with ethics. Because Americans want to have their cake and eat it too. They don't want to have to change what they do. They want to continue doing whatever they want, and it's all for me, and what's in it for me kind of thing. And so they want to have some great religious experience that solves all their problems while they continue doing whatever they want. as a lawyer who came to retreat one year, asked, I'm really serious about doing Buddhist practice, but in my particular firm, law firm, I'm expected to lie a lot. Tell me how I can be a good Buddhist and lie at the same time. So, we had to give him some bad news. So to look at your behavior, because your behavior actually supports or detracts from having a calm and steady and radiant mind, a clear mind. So if you lie or steal or harm other people, or those things are all disruptive for your own inner life. And if your inner life is disruptive, it's very hard to be very stable and clear and look deeply. So the Buddha talked about right speech. Speech is so important that he has one of the eight steps is looking at your speech and practicing careful speech. The other is right action, living ethically. And then interestingly, the third of the ethical steps is right livelihood. To choose, if you can, to choose a livelihood that is supportive of your deepest intentions and values. The Buddha gave a couple of examples of things you shouldn't be doing, absolutely. It's very rare in Buddhism we have actually very clear, absolute suggestions. And the Buddha said that you should not deal in weapons. You should not deal in drugs and alcohol. You should not deal in human beings. So you can't be a pimp, for example, or a slave. Back in ancient India, they sold slaves. So you can't deal in human beings, alcohol or drugs, or with weapons. But the point is to look at our livelihood and to really be honest about it. And is it right, what we're doing, how we live our life? Does it support our deepest values and intention? Is it in harmony with what we're trying to do in our life? Then the last three, so two have to do with reflections, looking at our intentions and understanding the Four Noble Truths. Three have to do with ethics, our speech, our action, and our livelihood. And three have to do with meditation. One of them is mindfulness. The other is developing our stability of mind, our concentration. And the third is to put our energy behind our spiritual life, to be engaged in doing it. I know plenty of people who are very serious about a spiritual life, spiritual practice. It's very important for them. And all they ever do is read a menu. If you go to a restaurant and all you ever do is eat the menu, you can get very hungry. So they endlessly read books, they endlessly listen to Dharma talks or whatever, and they're very inspired, it kind of uplifts them and all that, but they never actually put it into practice. They never put their energy into it and really to apply themselves. There has to be the effort, has to be there. Or each of us has to do it for ourselves. The very famous quote in Buddhism, that you have to do it for yourself, the Buddha only shows the way. The Buddha only gives the map, you have to follow the road yourself. So in Buddhism tends to put a lot of responsibility on each individual practitioner to really do this process of mindfulness, of clarification, of looking deeply, very deeply, at what makes you tick, what drives you, and what drives you, how does it get in the way of your freedom? How does it cause you to suffering? How does it cause you to suffer? Can you be so honest about that? And then in doing that, to try to be have as much self-compassion, self-acceptance, and self-kindness towards yourself as possible. It's not so easy to grapple honestly and directly with all our inner psychic forces that are operating. And it's very, very important to try as best you can to meet yourself with kindness, with acceptance, with love and compassion. Even if you can do, even if it's just a little teeny little bit of, you can do that. Whatever small amount you can muster of meeting yourself with some kindness and gentleness, it's really, really important for this whole process of learning how to live free and to begin letting go of all the ways in which we suffer in an optional way. As you have more experience, as you continue your practice and you have more experience about how this actually works in your life, and you see the causes of your suffering, you see the possibility of letting go and releasing yourself from that suffering, you'll get confidence. And one of the forms of confidence is you'll understand more and more how the Four Noble Truths apply to all areas of our life. How it's really, it's the leather that goes in the soul that allows you to step across the queendom. It's very, very, very powerful. And if you have really understand it thoroughly, the Four Noble Truths, you'll be able to go through life with a tremendous confidence, because you understand that So I hope that that this talk will encourage you to think more deeply and maybe read some books about the Four Noble Truths and reflect. And then apply them to your life. See, do they apply? Is there some way in which these categories actually work for your life? They actually talk about some things that go on for you. And then as you do that work, that it gives birth inside of you of a kind of trust, a kind of confidence, a kind of well-being, that where you can enter into life, even in the difficult aspects of life, with a kind of grace, a kind of trust, a kind of ease. So would anyone like to ask any questions? Yes?
Just repeat, like, step six, seven, and eight have to do with what?
Meditation.
And then what was... break it down to six, seven, and eight words.
Oh, I'll go through all eight of them once more. So there's they're all preceded by right, or proper, or complete. Different English translators translate differently. Most commonly right. There's right understanding, there's right intention, there's right speech, there's right action, there's right livelihood, there's right effort, there's right mindfulness, and there's right concentration. Yes?
I'm not sure how to word this, but it seems like there's a difference between learning how to meditate and becoming aware of the fear that you might be feeling, for example, and being fearless.
Yes.
And the first one, the being aware of fear, to me, I can relate to that. But being fearless seems like another step beyond. And I'm wondering, is that because someone who's fearless has done this for years and years and that develops, or it's just a different way of talking about it?
There's two kinds of fearlessness. One is to actually have no fear at all. And the other is to have fear, but have the fear not be a problem, not get in the way. It's there, but it doesn't interfere. We make our choices and do what we have to do. It doesn't bother us. It's kind of just there. If I may take this opportunity to say, make this point. The whole process of the Four Noble Truths is actually quite lovely. And a little bit... it was just lovely, kind of almost paradoxical, perhaps. But so we start with something which is maybe uncomfortable, like fear. To be honest, we see that, and then rather than initially addressing the fear itself, we might be looking at how we relate to that fear, because we might be afraid of our fear, we might be angry at our fear, embarrassed about having the fear, all kinds of things. And so the practice is to look at how we hold something like fear first. Until all the ways in which we hold it have softened, and we hold it in a light, compassionate, generous way, an easy way, a trustful way. So it's a beautiful thing. So we begin learning how we don't have to have fear of fear or aversion of fear. We can just let fear be there by itself. So that's a huge step. It's a beautiful thing. Then, once we've done that work, and when you see the fear for itself without any of the filters of our reactions to it, then you might be able to see more deeply into the fear and see if it's the case, see some of the ways in which you hold yourself in life, some of the values or images of yourself that you hold yourself that might cause those particular fears. And if you see the, if you start seeing the structure of what creates those fears, the holding that creates those fears, then you might be able to begin to let go of them, release them. The experience of awakening in Buddhism, so-called enlightenment, can be described, as I said earlier, as experience of trust. All-pervasive trust. We trust life completely. There's no resistance and no fear. Yeah?
In Buddhism, is there a difference between sort of right fear and sort of optional fear? I'm walking through the jungle and I encounter a tiger.
Sure, sure.
Does Buddhism make a differentiation in their, we call it fear, and is there two different words?
Well, in the teachings of the Buddha, he doesn't make that distinction. And there's lots of examples of monks, even in the century, who've gone into the jungles of Thailand where there are wild animals and tigers in order to face their fears about those animals and tigers. And they've really worked hard. And unfortunately, some of the monks died. So it's not exactly, but there are lots of examples of monks who didn't die and who actually have wonderful stories of encountering tigers and all kinds of wild animals. So to the degree to which maybe even some of the things that initially might seem as kind of cellular fear is really cellular and is, you know, an interesting question. My own sense in responding to your question is that there is kind of cellular, automatic, or kind of primal core fear that can arise, that it's quite appropriate. There's a kind of, if you're kind of perched on the edge of Half Dome with, you know, standing on one foot looking down, I think it's appropriate to have some fear, you know, to have the body tighten up and have that kind of reaction, or a car barreling down at you. You know, there's fear which is appropriate. Most people in our modern world are not facing down tigers. Most of the fear and anxiety we have doesn't come from real fear, but rather real situation, but often very imaginary. What's going to happen to us, what we think people are thinking about us. But what's interesting, so I'm kind of a little bit wishy-washy about answering your question, but what's interesting is that the Buddha made some very clear distinctions between healthy and unhealthy fear. And the healthy fear that he talked about was not fear of tigers, but the healthy fear he talked about was fear about transgressing your own integrity, violating your own integrity, being really afraid of doing that. And that's healthy. It's considered to be one of the he called it one of the guardians, protectors of the world. And a person who doesn't have that fear of violating their own integrity is a dangerous person.
This is meant as a joke, but could you consider Buddhism as one of the first 12-step programs?
You know, about a year ago, Yvonne Rand came and gave a talk. Were you here for the Monday night talk? I asked her to give a talk on that very topic, addiction and Buddhist practice. And she spent a lot of time studying AA and the whole issue of addiction, and she gave a very nice talk, weaving these two together. And I haven't done the study, but she's told me repeatedly that she feels that there's a lot of similarities between AA and Buddhism.
Gil?
Yes.
Thich Nhat Hanh has a new book out entitled "Jesus and Buddha Are Brothers." Yet my first pass on that title, that concept, seems to make that not hard for me to understand. Because I think the Buddha talks about, it seems, what you're saying, relinquishing and getting away from desire as a path to desire, desire being a path to suffering.
I remember I was very careful not to use the word desire.
Right. Well, let's say not thirsting, but what I'm trying to get at is that it seems the Christians or Christianity or Jesus was putting a thirst, was trying to almost generate a thirst or, you know, proselytize a thirst for, you know the path to God and do these right things. Do you see Jesus and Buddha as being brothers? Or do you see what Thich Nhat Hanh's going for?
I would prefer to see them as brothers. I'm not qualified to answer your question. It's a good question. I haven't studied enough Christianity to really be able to say that. I have studied enough to know that there's at least two or three, if not a million, interpretations of the Gospels, and so it all depends how you do the reading and what you read out of it. And I've read some wonderful Christian mystics where it seems that what they're talking about seems really comparable. I remember meeting a Catholic monk named Brother Steindl-Rast, David Steindl-Rast, some years ago, and him saying that he felt more in common with Buddhist monastics than he did with Christian lay people, because they shared not only a kind of similar lifestyle, but similar depth of experiences that were very similar in both Catholic monastic practice and Buddhist monastic practice. If you ask people to meet each other at the level of their experience, you find a lot more commonality, much more brotherhood and sisterhood, than if you ask people to meet each other at the level of their theology, their beliefs. And so, my preference is when I meet a Christian is not, I'm not that interested in even Buddhist theology. There is such a thing. But I'm really interested in how people are living their lives and how it feels to be with someone and how they're working with their difficulties and working with their, the grace that comes with practice. So from that point of view, I think we share a common humanity. Yeah?
You made some reference to reading books on the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
Which books might you suggest, or were you referring to?
Do you have a recommendation?
I was curious what you were referring to.
No, it wasn't anything particular. Nothing. There's a lot of books. Always a lot of books. Good luck. You start with books, you'll never end. I'm sorry, I recommended it, but I don't have a concrete suggestion. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of books talk about the Four Noble Truths. It doesn't have to be. I kind of like people poking around finding their own way in books. So let's end with a little mini sitting. Highly efficient sitting. If you're waiting for something to happen, you've already missed the boat. Thank you all.